The following program was broadcast on Wednesday evening, May 3rd, 1961, by television station WTTW Channel 9, Chicago's educational television station. The program was Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Science Reporter, and the subject was Aldous Huxley on Image and Reality.
From the French window, I walked out under a kind of arbor covered in part by a climbing rose tree, in part by lasts 1 inch wide with a 1/2 inch of space between them. The sun was shining and the shadows of the lasts made a zebra-like pattern on the ground and across the seat and back of the garden chair, which was standing at this end of the arbor. That chair, shall I not forget it? Where the shadows fell on the canvas upholstery, stripes of a deep but glowing indigo alternated with stripes of an incandescent so intensely bright that it was hard to believe that they could be made of anything else but blue fire. For what seemed an immensely long time, I gazed without knowing, even without wishing to know what it was that confronted me. At any other time, I would have seen a chair barred with alternate light and shade. Today, the precept had swallowed up the concept. I was so completely absorbed in looking, so thunderstruck by what I actually saw, that I could not be aware of anything else. It was inexpressibly wonderful. Wonderful to the point almost of being terrifying. And suddenly, I had an inkling of what it must feel like to be mad.
From The Doors of Perception by Aldous Huxley, who is at MIT this term as currently visiting professor of humanities. Mr. Huxley, going into a garden and seeing a chair under an arbor is a very ordinary kind of experience for most people. Why was this so intense and so vivid for you?
Well, it happened in the course of an experiment which I was doing at that time with a doctor friend of mine, an experiment with the drug mescaline, which immensely enhances the intensity of all visual impressions. And this was what happened, that this chair with these stripes of light and shadow upon it seemed, as I say, as I try to explain in this passage, seemed, one can only use the word supernatural in their intensity.
Is this the kind of experience which is only accessible through the use of a drug?
I think in this degree of intensity it probably is. But this whole problem of perception is one which has interested me a great deal in recent years. We know now from the study of perception that actually what we see, what we perceive, isn't just passively received by us, that we impose upon the external world patterns which have been formed in our mind through this sort of concept system we have. We have the system of labels and categories and names. And that what we see is in some sort a kind of illustration, a concrete illustration of the abstractions inside our heads. And now, the remarkable fact about mescaline is that in some way we bypass this verbal side of our mind, and we tend to see the external world almost as it is in itself, as it comes to us directly, without immediately imposing names and labels upon it. I mean, this was the reason why this chair for me was not a chair, because I didn't immediately when I saw it, didn't immediately say, this is a chair and these are the stripes of light and color, light and shadow on it. I just saw the thing in itself, and it was so extraordinary. Now, the significance of all this can be understood, I think, better as regards to a normal state of mind. If we look at paintings, for example, like those of Van Gogh, well, it's quite clear, if you look at Van Gogh's paintings, that he saw the world with a degree of intensity which most of us never see the world with at all. He was seeing it almost, I would say, as people who have taken mescaline see it. He was seeing not the concrete illustrations of an abstraction in his head, but, so to say, the thing in itself, the immediate impression was coming to him raw, without his imposing upon it any structure from within the sort of conventional mold inside his skull. Now, this to me is something of great interest. I mean, can we, so to say, make the best of both worlds? Can we make the best of the world of concepts, the world of words and of ideas which we have and which, after all, are the basis of all civilized life? And at the same time, can we make the best of this sort of pure aesthetic emotion, pure aesthetic sensation of seeing the thing as it is in itself? This is something which interests me very much indeed.
And this is the great difficulty, then, trying to see what it really is, see the reality of it.
Well, seeing this aspect of reality, because, I mean, we live in a human world, and the human world always must contain these conceptual elements in it. I mean, this is why it's a human world, because it is a world which we fit automatically into our pattern of conceptions. But there are degrees in this, and I think it would be extremely valuable for all of us if, at any rate, sometimes we could see the world as Van Gogh saw it, or even to some, almost as the mescaline taker sees it. That is to say, with the kind of extraordinary intensity which comes when we don't see it through the spectacles of our concept system.
In the passage that we heard from your book and in your discussion of Van Gogh, this has been almost entirely a visual effect that we've been talking about. Does the same thing hold true, say, for the sense of taste or for what the ear can hear? Is this able to be magnified, to be intensified in the same way that the color can be?
In the case of, say, of mescaline, I don't know. I think people who do experience the world mainly in musical terms probably do get the same kind of intensification. In general, I think for most people, the music is very, very important when heard under the influence of mescaline, but there isn't the same kind of transfiguration of the individual tones into a higher degree of intensity. What there is this curious sense that time has ceased, and that although the tempo of the music has not changed, the music itself is developing in a kind of timeless world. It's as though we had passed from time into eternity, and it becomes possible in this condition to understand what some of the ancient philosophers meant when they spoke about eternity. For example, there's a Latin phrase to describe eternity which calls it a nunc stans, a standing now. And you get this definitely, this impression. You feel that the music is a standing now, that it's changing all the time, but changing not in a dimension of seconds and minutes, but changing, so to speak, in another kind of dimension, in a dimension of reality, a dimension of intensity, a dimension of beauty, so that there is a remarkable change in regard to music, certainly, with mescaline, but of a rather different kind from the change which takes place in regard to visual events.
And yet this is a pharmaceutical solution to the problem, isn't it, of trying to experience this intensity?
And of course it would, I think for ordinary purposes, this is, so to say, going too far. This is too much of a good thing. It has a degree of intensity which is quite terrifying. And it's very significant to see in the biography of Van Gogh that, and in his pictures, one can see that he was seeing the outside world with an intensity so tremendous that sometimes it was, as I hinted in this passage in The Doors of Perception, absolutely terrifying. And after all, Van Gogh ended as a suicide. And when one sees his last three pictures, which I did the other day at an excellent loan exhibition I was in Los Angeles, I was looking at, you can understand why he committed suicide, because the world was looking so fearful in its intensity. It was a kind of negative intensity. But no wonder the poor man had to could blow his brains out. But I don't think, I mean, to start with, this is the result of a drug. But I think, without any doubt, that a great deal can be done to help us to make the best of both worlds, to help us to make the best of the verbal world, and also of this world of immediate experience. I think there are psychological methods for producing this.
Well, why aren't we able to see this way? Not perhaps with the same intensity as Van Gogh, but at least part way to that intensity.
Well, this is a very interesting problem. I don't know if you remember the great poem of Wordsworth, the Ode on the Intimations of Immortality in Childhood. What Wordsworth describes there is the kind of transfigured world in which he lived as a child, where everything had what he calls the glory and the freshness of a dream. And as he grew up into boyhood, he lost this, and the world faded into the light of common day. Now, I suspect very much that this isn't an isolated phenomenon. I think probably a great many children see the world in this transfigured way. They see a world which is much more like what we imagine the Garden of Eden to have been like. And that as they progress in their analytical education, their verbal and conceptual education, this is somehow gradually flattened out, that they tend to see things not as they are in themselves, not as direct experiences, but always through the spectacles of their conceptual system. I mean, they see things, as I put it before, as concrete illustrations of the abstractions which they've learned. And I think this is one of the reasons why, for most adults, the world is, in a sense, as dull as it seems to be. A few specially gifted people, I mean, like Van Gogh, obviously, like Monet, like many of the great artists, continue to see the world with this extraordinary freshness and brightness and intensity. But most of us go through the process which is described by Wordsworth and lose this impression of the world filled with the brightness and the freshness of a dream, and see it as something rather drab and boring even. I think this is probably the main reason why we don't see as Van Gogh saw.
And it's in a case like Van Gogh where we can see almost the end product of this ability to perceive that here is almost the equivalent to the masculine state.
Yes, well, he of course, I mean, poor man, he was mentally unbalanced, and he sort of was pushed over the edge by this. He was not under control. He was, I mean, I think in a case like that, and in the case of somebody who is temporarily under the influence of mescaline, he is not in a position to move back and forth at will from one world to the other. I mean, it seems to me that the really desirable state to be in is one in which we can at will pass from the humanly normal world of concepts into the world of immediate experience. To pass from this world where we attach a name and a label and a category to everything into this other world where a chair with stripes of light and darkness on it seems to be some sort of miraculous and supernatural object. I mean, not to the extent of which you get under mescaline, but to a considerable extent, so that you get this freshness and brightness, and at the same time, when you want to, you can think about the world in a perfectly rational way in terms of your concept system.
And the child then can see to a certain extent perhaps the way Van Gogh could, and yet he can deal with this. He can...
Yes, I mean that the normal child, I mean, does find the other thing quite easy to move back and forth between the two. And then, of course, in the case of the child, I mean, you only have to look at children's art. Although he probably sees the world with this Monet-like or Van Gogh-like intensity, he does not possess the ability to render this. I mean, when he draws a picture, he always draws a picture which is purely symbolic. I mean, it's a kind of Neolithic art, so to speak, which is an art of patterns and of symbols, and not an impressionist art, because he just doesn't have the capacity to render this in any way. So that one sees that his mind is working quite easily in both worlds at once, in the symbolic world of his drawings and in the intensely vivid world of his immediate perceptions.
So then this is an ability which is at least originally in all of us, and then as we are educated in the conceptual idea, we begin to lose.
Yes, well, I don't know whether it's in all of us, but I suspect that it's in a great many of us, let us say, and that that the Wordsworthian picture in the Ode on the Intimations of Immortality is probably a very good psychological description of what many people go through.
And yet, isn't there perhaps something of just getting used to reality? If I go to a foreign city I've never been in for the first few days or weeks, it is very vivid and intense. The sounds and the sights or smells are altogether new and different. And yet after a while I can walk through the streets and not be aware of the city as I originally was. Does the child perhaps have that kind of experience too?
Yes, I think he does. I mean, after all, we say that familiarity breeds contempt. Not necessarily contempt, but it breeds indifference. But isn't this a very undesirable thing? I mean, wouldn't it be much better if we all of us could, by suitable psychological exercises, retain some of that freshness and wonder which we get when we go to a new city? I mean, it is really very unfortunate that because we take the same walk along the same streets every day, that the streets seem so dull and uninteresting, whereas actually each day the effects of light are a little different, the moisture on the pavement is different, and so on. But if we had the impressionist's eye in this matter, we should be continually seeing something new and brilliant. I mean, for example, there's a delightful story about Cézanne. Somebody asked him, "Don't you get very bored with painting this same mountain, this Mont Sainte-Victoire, almost every day of the week?" He says, "Why should I get bored? I only have to change the position of my easel 8 feet to get an entirely different view." And how wonderful this is, that a man can find the view of a single mountain absolutely inexhaustible simply by moving a couple of paces away. And he again obviously had this intensity of vision.
Well, you mentioned the possibility of exercises to do this. What kind of exercises could there be that would help us to train and develop this function or this ability?
Well, I can imagine various kinds of exercise. I've actually seen this at work. My wife, who is a lay therapist, often uses this kind of exercise with neurotic patients, of getting them to look at a flower. I mean, if you can look at a flower in two ways, you see. You can look at it in the conceptual, scientific way. You look at the flower, and you say it has so many petals, it has so many stamens, etc. I don't know how many petals that has. It has an awful lot. But I mean, anyhow, you can examine it in this scientific way and attach labels to every part of it and analyze it and even make a scientific drawing of it, indicating what all the parts of the thing are. And then you can make the best of both worlds by passing from this scientific view of the flower to what may be called the aesthetic view. You can let the vision of the flower come to you in a completely passive and receptive way, so that you're not looking at it as illustrating a series of botanical abstractions, but simply as a beautiful object in itself. And I think exercises like this can be extraordinarily helpful. They can be extraordinarily helpful in regard to neurosis, for example, simply by getting people back into the present here and now, which is when most neurotic people are living somewhere else. And this is very valuable in that respect. But I think it can be extremely valuable for everybody by helping them to live in these two worlds at once. I mean, not at once, but I mean to be able to pass at will from one to the other, to look at the object analytically and conceptually, and then to look at it in what my old friend Roger Fry used to call a state of alert passivity, which is the essentially the way the artist looks at the outside world, so that one sees not this analyzed and conceptualized object, but one gets the direct impression of the thing with the minimum of conceptual ideas imposed upon it from inside our skulls.
Does this mean that we're dealing, say, with the flower, with the aesthetics of the flower, or is it something much broader than that?
Well, I think, I mean, on one aspect it's the aesthetics, but it is the, it's getting as near as possible to what the philosopher Immanuel Kant said was always impossible for us to realize, the thing in itself. I mean, no one has ever seen the thing in itself, but there are degrees of things in their selfness. You can see things almost as they come to us immediately and passively, and then you can see things as we impose our categories upon them, and we, I think, undoubtedly can train ourselves to see more vividly the things as we get them in this state of alert passivity. I mean, it's very important, I think, that we should train ourselves in both fields.
You mentioned the use of this in psychiatric therapy or treatment. Are there other instances where this concept has been used to such
a... Well, for example, in a book which was published, I think, in 1951, a book by three authors, Perls, Hefferlein, and Goodman, called Gestalt Therapy, there are a great many exercises of awareness, of being aware of objects in the outer world, of being aware of, well, of kinesthetic movements, being aware of what it feels like to lift a hand, for example, of being aware of the images going on inside one's head and of one's imagination. And before that, there was for the first 30 years of this century, there was a Swiss doctor, Vitos, who used essentially the same method in treating neurotics with great success in Lausanne. And unfortunately, when he died, the work almost completely disappeared. And you will find similar exercises in direct awareness prescribed in many of the old Oriental texts, above all in the texts of Tantric Buddhism. You will find whole lists of these exercises in awareness, which were regarded as a very valuable training for the final change of consciousness to the state of liberation and enlightenment. So that we have a considerable tradition, I mean, both an old religious tradition and in recent times a certain medical therapeutic tradition of the value of this thing.
Well, you mentioned a while back the kinesthetics of this. We have been talking, I suppose, more of art and of fine art. How does this work with an experience that is kinesthetic rather than one that is purely visual or auditory?
Well, frankly, I don't exactly know, but for example, in regard to mescaline, this alters, without any doubt, the normal kinesthetic experience. But there are, again, a number of techniques for training people to be aware of their kinesthetic experiences. For example, John Dewey wrote with immense enthusiasm about the method developed by F.M. Alexander for, first of all, becoming aware of kinesthetic experiences, and also for getting into the right postural state, I mean, the proper relationship between the head and neck and the trunk. And Dewey wrote prefaces to three of his books and mentioned the work also in his book on human nature. in the chapter on habits. And there is here again a considerable mass of knowledge in regard to this, all of which I think could be applied with great profit to education in general, on every level, from the kindergarten up to death, if you like.
Well, you mentioned just the raising of an arm. What kinds of things could we be aware of in the lifting of an arm?
Well, you can be aware. I mean, there are several ways. I mean, you can sort of lift it carelessly. You can lift it with a deliberate degree of voluntary act. You have it as a fully voluntary act. You can lift it with tension. You can lift it with relaxation. And, I mean, all these things, for example, in regard to a neurotic, are extraordinarily helpful, because he goes through life with a frightful unawareness of what is happening here and now. But again, I think, quite apart from any therapeutic value, that this increase of awareness is likely to make the world seem more interesting and more enjoyable to people. And I am personally strongly of the belief that boredom and uninterest are one of the main causes of delinquency. I mean, why do people behave in such a delinquent way? Because they find the world so frightfully boring that this is the only thing that gives them any kick. Whereas if we did get some pleasure out of looking at a flower or walking along the street or being aware of the motions within our own body, life would be so incomparably more interesting that we shouldn't have to go out and behave as abominably as so many of us do.
We'd be able to see more of the world in a way, then.
Much more of the world, and I would say, too, that this has some value, too, in relation to science. I mean, particularly of the sciences of observation. After all science is ultimately based upon perception. I mean, even the most abstract physical science is based upon the perception of pointer readings, and the moment you get into the field of biology, the direct perception becomes of very great importance, and in ethology, the study of animal behavior, it is absolutely crucial. So that I think even in the limited field of the sciences, this thing can be of very great importance.
But primarily then it's a problem of education, educating the adult to a certain extent recapture this ability he may have had.
I think so. I mean, I would always use this phrase. The problem is to teach people how to make the best of both worlds. I mean, the rational, conceptual, verbal world, which should certainly we should study with the greatest care, and I think undoubtedly we should have much more education in semantics than we do have, so that we know how to use these words properly and how not to be taken in by them. And at the same time, we should also be taught how to live in a state of alert passivity in regard to external events and in regard to internal events too, so that we do have the possibility of living both here and now and in this abstract world of words.
Thank you very much, Mr. Huxley. We hope that you'll be with us next week at the same time.
I believe that they could be made of anything else but blue fire. For what seemed an immensely long time, I gazed without knowing, even without wishing to know what it was that confronted me. At any other time, I would have seen a chair barred with alternate light and shade. Today, the precept had swallowed up the concept. I was so completely absorbed in looking, so thunderstruck by what I actually saw, that I could not be aware of anything else. It was...
You are watching Your Window to the World, WTEW, Channel 11, Chicago.